and welcome back to Authors Airways, where books come alive. This week, we're featuring a reading from Hayward Bruce Ewart III, Ph.D., who's the author of the upcoming book, Am I Bad? Recovering from Abuse. Hayward will be reading from Chapter 2 in his book, and you can learn more about Am I Bad? Recovering from Abuse at www.recoveringfromabuse.com. Father Hayward B. Ewart III, Ph.D., has devoted more than 24 years of his professional life to the protection and treatment of women, children, and the family. During the Carter administration, he served the White House Conference on Families, and such leadership continues to this day. He is not only a veteran clinician in the mental health field, but also a distinguished teacher at the university level and an active chaplain. Through Zoe University in Jacksonville, Florida, his video lectures have been used by distance learning students across the U.S. and in 41 countries. A much sought-after public speaker, Dr. Ewart is a commanding presenter who speaks with great passion on the issues of abused women and children. Now let's sit back and hear the voice of the author, Hayward Bruce Ewart III, reading from Am I Bad? Recovering from Abuse. For a Loving Healing Press, this is Victor Volkman at Authors Airwaves, www.authorsairwaves.com.
Hello and welcome. This is Dr. Hayward Ewart, and I'm reading from my new book, Am I Bad? Recovering from Abuse. I'm reading from Chapter 2, A New Developmental Model, The Recovery of Self. A critically important factor added to this new developmental model is the concept of survival needs. It is my assertion that the needs of the child are the needs of the adult. That is, needs do not change, and they do not go away. Even when needs are met, they remain to be fulfilled again and again. When not met, they will scream out in the form of behavioral, affective, cognitive, or personality disorders, either episodically or chronically. The most important need in the maturation process at any stage is affirmation of the true self. Several of the extant models, such as those of Piaget and Erickson, emphasize needs in childhood. But the reason that needs are permanent throughout life is that they arise from the true self, from the child within us all. The adopted self of adulthood is not the real person, but only an artificial construct. The true self is the one who comes directly from the womb. Correct verbal and nonverbal messages on the part of parents is always critical, even in adolescence. A boy needs a father, and a girl needs a mother, just as much as in earlier stages. A father who has suffered neglect or rejection by his own father will be not only hampered but often utterly crippled in his ability to be open, approachable, and affectionate, especially to a son. The effect of an inadequate father, whether neglectful or demanding, is never less than devastating to the son's personhood. The son is prevented from having a full sense of being a male. Father is the one who grants the rite of passage to manhood, and he is also the one who can block it. If the boy sees no hand extended and hears no voice saying in some way, "Welcome to manhood," he never fully arrives in his own mind, but carries the sense of being more boy than man all his life. A daughter denied affirmation by a father lives out her whole life with a sense of not completely existing. The lives of such unfortunates are continuous efforts to stave off the fear of annihilation, worse than the fear of death. Feeling as though one doesn't exist is more terrifying than the knowledge that one will someday die. Daughters go to extremes to counter this bottomless deficit. They will take a tyrannical father and make him in their own fantasies a sweet, wonderful man. Or they will search for their real father in relationship after relationship, never realizing whom they are really leaving each time they break from a partner. They will fight their own buried conviction that they must indeed be loathsome if my own father couldn't love me, and they will invariably transfer these voids and fears onto their concept of God. Sometimes they will sell their bodies with the meager comfort of feeling that I must be worth something if men will pay money for me. A similar phenomenon can be seen in the ambitious model or actress who endlessly pursues some important person to take my picture. The personal account of one of my own recent patients graphically illustrates this point as follows. I married at 17, was a virgin, and wanted to leave home. I rationalized a lot, you see. I prided myself in the fact that I stayed a virgin, although my parents were very strict. I married the first man I dated. I got pregnant on my honeymoon. When my husband later beat me and my 3-month-old daughter, I divorced him. My dad moved me and my daughter back home. The second man I had sex with looked surprised when I asked him if he was going to hurt me, and he said no. What I meant to ask was whether he was going to hurt me emotionally, and he did. All I meant to him was sex. The one thing I was proud of, being a virgin, was long gone, so I rationalized that this was the cause of my increasing promiscuity. I was good at rationalizing. I made up my own philosophies, and then would change them or add to them to make some sense of the deep emotional wounds with a tremendous amount of pain. My parents were too strict. I regretted ever being such a good girl. Why didn't I go ahead and just have sex before marriage? After all, I probably wouldn't have ended up beaten, and I wouldn't have had the silly dreams that I could actually be happily married, or just plain old happy. It wasn't until recently that I found out that I was set up for all of this from the age of 4. My mom was physically and verbally abused when she was growing up, and her dad was alcoholic. My dad was an alcoholic from a divorced home, and both of his parents were killed by automobiles when my dad was very young, around 11 or 12. He lived with his mom's parents after his mom and dad divorced when he was about 7. His mom moved 300 miles away to find work and didn't see him often, but made sure he was well dressed. Dad had a sister who was diagnosed as schizophrenic in her 40s after she cursed out the phone company and served time in prison for it. That's almost all I know about my parents' histories. Dad doesn't talk much about his family. He's a very emotional man, but emotionally unavailable to me. That brings me to the remembrance of one of the many times he hurt my feelings and one of my brothers came out to comfort me. He told me I had to understand my dad was a drill sergeant and his military policeman in the army. His way of treating me was to make me tough. I didn't buy it then, and I still don't buy it now. Nor do I excuse it. This thing runs in families, you know. This is a dysfunction, if you haven't guessed yet. There was a lot of verbal and physical abuse from my parents, but no matter how bad it was, my mother's reply was that our life was never as bad as what she had to endure growing up. I did the best I could, she said, and I treated all you kids the same. I don't think I did too bad when I was raising you kids, and I wouldn't have anyone but your dad. He's the only man for me. All this when I know different. My dad's responses, behavior, and attitude were always, and I mean always, negative. Except, of course, when it came to babies. He had 7 of us, and he could handle babies. He loved babies. But when each of us became about 5 years old, the distance began. I know. I watched it happen. I was the oldest of us 7. It was most of the time, it's too hot or it's too cold. You're stupid. That's stupid. What's wrong with you? Your hair looks like you know what. You should know better. You always have your head up your you know what. And then total indifference. It was and still is impossible to get any warmth from him, and I really tried all my life. About 1.5 years ago, I really thought I had caught on to something when at the funeral of my 19-year-old nephew, I was really hurting from seeing him in the casket for the first time, and I held on to my daddy and asked him to tell me he loved me, and he did. And even patted me gently on the back and gave me a hug. The first time I called to chat after that, I ended the conversation with, "I love you." And he said, "I love you." I really thought things had changed. I was so happy. The next time I called, I ended with, "I love you." And the response was, "Yeah." And that's the end of the quote from my patient. In late adolescence, the young person begins for the first time to consider the future and begins to look at various occupations. The choice of the way to make a living is restricted to no more than I deserve, just as the choice of a partner is limited by the same measure, no better than I deserve. Many daughters are brought up with the unspoken message that their job for life is to serve mother. A mother companion can be guaranteed success by convincing the daughter from the earliest time that there is something not quite right about her, the child, and that she can never make it on her own. Mothers who place little value on their daughters' lives compared to their own can have a servant for life by always being unhappy and never letting the daughter please her fully. There was once in my care a 67-year-old woman who 40 years previously had divorced her husband in favor of coming back to mother. Mother, now 93, was still not pleased at all with her daughter, who complained during one session, "Dr. Ewart, my mother treats me like a little girl. I'm not a little girl. I'm a big girl." Then mother shot back, "Then act like one." This daughter was a retired director of nursing at a major medical center. In her professional career, she enjoyed the highest respect and recognition of her colleagues, but none of them had designs on her as a servant. The same tragic game can play between a mother and her son. Never having gotten her needs met through her husband, she turns to her son for emotional support. Some young men, and some not so young, find that drug or alcohol abuse provides justification for never leaving home. It is more face-saving to be home due to addictive disease than to be there because you can't leave your mother. Some men go to another extreme, having an extramarital affair in order to destroy the marriage, after which they can go home. Such men have then been able to say that the marriage was destroyed by an affair rather than the primary need to go home. The same happens with women. In fact, one of the main causes of infidelity, in my experience, is the need to go back home. Often I can quickly determine the cause of the breakup by watching where the partners go once the marriage is over. Husbands and wives have been shocked to discover in therapy that it wasn't a sexual tryst that did them in, but in fact an emotional affair with a parent. Having come through the emotion-charged personality experiments of adolescence, the adult sense of identity is now an adopted self, a culmination of earlier opinions plus the trial and error of the teens. It is this adopted self that governs the adult, with the result that very few individuals ever take a look back and question the messages of childhood. Most people go to their graves without an accurate idea of who they are or who they should have become. The sense of becoming is related to the perception of power. A sense of being and having power are required in order to stave off the fear of annihilation, the greatest of all fears that mankind retains. A sense of becoming fosters the substance of being, and with being comes power. The greater the sense of being, the greater the sense of power to resist the fear of annihilation that threatens at all times to penetrate into full consciousness. This fear is so basic and so horrible, far exceeding the fear of death, that it is not faced by mankind. But how does one come to be, and thus gain the power for living? Viktor Frankl asserts that all of mankind is searching for the meaning of life, and that this meaning is a primary ingredient for the survival of personhood. Abraham Maslow sees self-actualization as the desired outcome in his developmental model, an exciting concept that formed the basis for the human potential movement. Maslow believed that if the environment is right, people grow straight and beautiful, actualizing the potentials they have inherited. Such a premise somewhat resembles my own experience and practice. However, he said the only reason that people would not move well in the direction of self-actualization is that hindrances are placed in the way by society, primarily the educational system. I would include the educational system, but the process of derailment begins in the preschool years and is powered more by parents than by teachers. Erik Erikson points to such holdbacks as shame and doubt, guilt, role confusion, and despair. Conversely, he believes that trust, autonomy, initiative, industry, identity, intimacy, generativity, and integrity to be the markers of successful development. Such qualities cannot be denied as measures of maturity. However, arriving at these levels is an ideal that few achieve. Late maturity, he postulates, brings the realization of wisdom and a period of reflection about life, or the regret over lost opportunity. On this last point, we are in absolute agreement. Many have considered the words what might have been the saddest in human experience. The popular duo Simon Garfunkel sing, A bad day is when I lie in bed and think of what might have been. According to my experience, discovering one's mission in life helps describe more than anything else who one really is. While Christians might refer to the concept as a calling, and others may term it destiny, it is essential that every individual have a sense of his or her life having a purpose, whether of value to one's creator, if such a belief is held, to society, or simply oneself. For many, the purpose of becoming can be the mere capacity to enjoy life fully by discovering and then celebrating who they really are. If one compares the brain to a computer, as in artificial intelligence, if you will, the slogan of programmers, garbage in, garbage out, is illustrative. It can be seen that the human mind, when inaccurately programmed, produces thinking and reacting that consist of cognitive malfunctions. It might be crudely said that the brain that registers false information has a software problem. Some, and perhaps many, forms of mental illness, whether a simple adjustment disorder or deep, chronic mental illness of major proportions, originate with a skewed or totally false sense of self. It is the mislearning during the developmental years that leads to psychopathology in many cases. The reason is that the adopted self, operating on false information, has too little power to stand up to the challenges of life or to maintain orderly direction. Now, before the critics begin to pounce, let me say clearly that my premise applies to many psychological disorders, not to all. Human beings are far too complicated to explain in terms of any one theory. Further, as psychology continues to take its place among the recognized sciences, having long ago graduated from being mere philosophy, genuine research in countless areas will provide ongoing information about the human psyche and the interrelatedness between body and mind. What I do mean to say is that the acquisition of misinformation has been largely overlooked in the etiology of mental illness, and therefore should be included as an exploration that could provide a major contribution to personality theory and psychopathology. Moving back to our model of development, we can see that an infant has no sense of becoming, that is, no sense of the development of self. From 2 to 6, however, the child explores the world of fantasy, an unbridled journey into activities, wishes, and imaginings that are uncensored by whether they are possible or not. Here we see the true self fully expressed in thousands of ways. Through all this activity of mind and body, the child is celebrating unrestricted being. There are no limits in the beginning period of this stage of development, and but few limits all the way to the end of this stage. It is this period that holds the primary clues as to who the person is. The child during this age period and the preceding is the true self. These stages, however, are highly vulnerable. Abuse at this time has more devastating consequences than at any other time, because the self is fully exposed, without protection. The self is open to receiving all information through sensation and through words. While the infant has no sense of power, the young child acquires a taste of power as he experiences people, objects, and his own body respond to his own will. This taste leads to a sense of power. The sense of power extends into the next stage, 6 to 13, where power must be constrained through outside influences. For example, discipline. But the child, while forced to submit to restrictions, maintains his belief that his power is unlimited, hence the illusion of power. It is here that we see little boys jumping out of trees to fly as Superman. They continue to imagine, no matter how many times they fall to the ground, that a jump is coming that will lead to flight. Boys dream of becoming firemen, doctors, policemen, and karate champions. Girls know they will be a princess, a model, or a ballerina when they grow up. Anything and everything is possible. But as children progress through this stage, their joy of becoming increasingly fades, as outside influence competes with their illusion of power and eventually wins, though only partially. In adolescence, about age 14 to 18, and perhaps beyond, the illusion of power has not been extinguished but only confined. This power, though nebulous, remains ready for expression, and the teen is compelled to find some way to put the power back in force for real. He rebels against the authority of other people, especially parents, and enters a search to find a clear channel of expression. Besides the constraints of authority, another enemy of this power is lack of self. The teen, driven by social pressure, must decide on an identity, true or false, that will lead to acceptance by the peer group. He has forgotten who he is, for the original self of early childhood has internalized so much information, accurate and inaccurate, that the self barely whispers. The adolescent must pick and choose to find an identity to try on for size. These years are, then, a period of experimental power and experimental becoming. The adopted self of adulthood is a combination of the earlier expressed opinions of others, plus the experimental choosing of a personality in late adolescence. Let me say that again. The adopted self of adulthood is a combination of the earlier expressed opinions of others, plus the experimental choosing of a personality in late adolescence. The sense of becoming has been compromised by this conglomeration of mostly inaccurate information. If the experimental personality has become a comfortable fit, the illusion of power will return. If the fit is uncomfortable, unworkable, or in dire contrast to the true self, an illusion of powerlessness will result. An illusion of power will result in a seeming self-confidence, while the illusion of powerlessness will give birth to a feeling of helplessness. An adult with seemingly high self-esteem and an adult with seemingly low self-esteem are equally deluded, since neither sense is based on truth. High self-esteemers tend to accomplish more in life by the world's standards, but in times of crisis they are just as vulnerable to psychopathology as are low self-esteemers. In the stock market crash of 1929, it was the successful who leapt out of windows to their death. Underachievers were in a much safer place, much less likely to lose materially. The roots of ambition are to stave off the fear of annihilation of self. The continual attainment of material things forms walls of false security around this fear. One worn-out man who came to me complained, "Everybody thinks I've got it made when they see my big house with two beautiful cars in the driveway, but they don't see what I have to go through to keep them." I saw the man several years later and learned that instead of working on the discovery of his true self, the only way to real security, he had spent his efforts in a new business and had become a millionaire. He boasted, "I'm in multi-level marketing." When and if the pyramid scheme collapses, he will have a long fall which could destroy him. Many people are too busy getting further lost to ask directions. They go in circles, but they move quickly. Some rush toward the goal their parents have set. Some continue a family tradition of taking over their father's business. Others stalk a career they think they may enjoy or change fantasies. And some do so, and some do practically nothing. Some are financially successful and yet miserable, and some are just miserable without all the pretense. Many are convinced they don't deserve any better than what they have. Young people set the course of their lives not by seeking their true identity, but by imitating their peers, adopting TV advertising propaganda at a deep, permanent level, and taking to themselves the ethics promoted on radio and in the movies. They purchase icons in the form of clothing labels and take their contempt for parents to the classroom, where they are encouraged in more defiance by their classmates. They placate themselves with the illusion of power, with the belief they already know all that is worth knowing, so that there is nothing more to be learned. Both teens and adults miss the minimal educational requirements for a fulfilling, meaningful life when they fail to discover who they are. An ecstatic preacher at the pinnacle of his sermon shouted to the faithful, "You are the pearl of great price." But these words only deepen the sorrow of a person without a sense of being. They feel that they are the exception. Perhaps every other person on earth fits in with this wonderful claim, but not them. What then can be done for the man who seems to hate himself, or the woman whose mind can't be changed, that she's not worthy to live? A partial answer for many forms of psychopathology is to look back and dissect the false information conveyed early in life, and then to rediscover self through exploring hidden talents and abilities. Yes, rediscover self. The self has been covered up, but not destroyed. The self cannot be destroyed, but only concealed. A beginning is to work on recalling who we were at the earliest times, before the product was tampered with, and by seriously trying out all the character traits, wishes, dreams, and fantasies of our child. This process, under the guidance of an insight-oriented therapist, is a start toward wholeness. This attainment, in most cases, is possible regardless of age, because the child within is unchangeable. Many believe this child is eternal. Thank you for listening. This is Dr. Hayward Ewart, author of Am I Bad? Recovering from Abuse.
And you've been listening to Hayward Bruce Ewart III, PhD, reading from his upcoming book, Am I Bad? Recovering from Abuse. You can learn more about Hayward's book at the special website, www.recoveringfromabuse.com. Thank you for listening to Author's Airwaves. I'm your host, Victor Volkman from Loving Healing Press, and we look forward to hearing from you next week at www.authorsairwaves.com.